Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Jonathan Safran Foer, author of Here I Am, published last year, but just being released in paperback tomorrow by Picador. As most of you know, Jonathan's previous works include Everything is Illuminated, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, Tree of Codes, and his nonfiction work, Eating Animals. The title Here I Am ostensibly refers to Abraham's response to God when the Lord calls out to him. The Lord tells Abraham, "Take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you." Now, what does this have to do with the book about Jacob and Julia Block, their foundering marriage, their three sons, Sam, Max, and Benji, grandfather Irv, great-grandfather Isaac, as they face the possible destruction of Israel and an upcoming bar mitzvah? It's the way Abraham responds, and it's a gnomon of the Jewish religion and culture. You don't respond by saying, "Hey," or "What's up," or "What do you need," or "I'll be there in a minute." It's just, "I am here. Here I am for whatever purpose you need. Ask of me." It could also mean that Jonathan is telling the reader, and there is an autobiographical tint to the book, Jonathan could be saying, "Here I am, guys. This is me. Not me like this is everything that happened in my life, but here's my brothers, here's my mom and dad, here's my elementary school, here's my synagogue." The key is, and it runs through it, the book, in Judaism, the Judaism of Jonathan and the way I was brought up, there's certain things you don't question. The unconditional love of a child, the obedience and loyalty to an ancestor, the belief in the preservation and defense of a homeland, and primarily, and you either have it or not, a rock-solid, non-resonating core set of beliefs that might make you a bit irritating or humorous, but gives you a bit of bedrock on which to stand. So with that, welcome, Jonathan, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. That's a really lovely welcome.
Well, it might be, thank you, but I might be wrong because I've heard you talk before, you know, and maybe you're sick of talking about the book because you've had a whole year in hardback and now you have to talk about it in paperback. But and so you've been asked pretty much every question and I'm trying to ask different ones. But in some of your interviews, you talk about Here I Am as the fact that that's the fatal flaw in Jacob's makeup, is that he can't reach that point, right?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's a fatal flaw in his makeup, but I think it's a struggle he has. And I think it's a struggle everybody has. You know, very, very few of us ever have, or I would venture to say none of us has as sort of dramatic a confrontation with identity as Abraham does on those scales. But we all know what it feels like to have kind of unresolved identities or identities that feel that they're in competition with one another, that they have to borrow from one another and sometimes take. You know, it could be the identity as a spouse and as an individual in the world. It could be identity as a parent and as a professional, as a religious person and as a political person. Each person has his own version and probably many versions. And so this book is organized around two crises. One is a discovered affair, a domestic crisis, and one is an earthquake in the Middle East, a global crisis. And they precipitate these events, these situations, that compel characters to make ultimate claims of identity, to say, "Here I am," at the expense of another identity. They can no longer, you know, as so many of us do, say, you know, "Here I sort of am, and here I sort of am, and here I sort of am, and I do my best to coordinate it all." But instead, I choose this over the others.
It's interesting because, I mean, Julie is so much more mature and closer to the "Here I am" kind of concept. And then Isaac is so cool, and then Sam and Max and Benji are so cool, and you know, sometimes when I'm reading a book, I'm waiting for a villain to set off things so that I can structure my own reading of the book so that I know who I like and who I dislike. And I notice in your writing, it's like there's really no bad guys. Is there like a bad guy in this book? I don't think there is there?
Well, I guess it sort of depends what you mean by bad guy. It's,
like,
you know,
like a villain, like a Snidely Whiplash, like somebody who ties a woman to a railroad track.
Right. No, that's definitely not how I think about it. And you know, not only is there no bad guy, but there's no
right or wrong.
Like the relationship between Jacob and Julia is not even a bad marriage.
It's not.
It's two people who really love each other, who are good, thoughtful people, and I think generally good to each other, who find this kind of encroaching distance between them, and a withholding, a measuring, a silence, and they don't really know why, and it's the not knowing why that makes it so tragic. You know, there is an affair which sort of breaks everything open, but it doesn't. It's a symptom. It's not the cause. You know, the cause or the originating event is this withholding. And there's a moment at the end of the book when Jacob and Julie are sitting together, and they discuss very explicitly why it is that they got divorced, and neither of them can really answer the question easily. And that's what makes it so sad. And I think the absence of a villain is also what makes it sad, when good people with good intentions are unable to live the lives that they ought to be living, unable to have the happiness that's like within reach and they deserve.
Yeah, it's much easier in today's world with today's technology. And this goes a little bit, I think, to your brother's new book, that like with the sexting, I mean, is the sexting, you're saying affair, and you change the definition of affair in your book. And it's like, is that sexting, is that really the violation of a sacrosanct vow that was made at the beginning of the marriage? And it's not really the reason why the marriage ends. Like you say, it's a symptom. But would you...
Well, I think one of the themes that's explored in the book is the power of words.
Yes. You know? Yeah.
And are words themselves action? The first event in the book, the first scene in the book, is Jacob and Julia, this married couple, in the principal or rabbi's office, because their oldest son was caught with a list of just inappropriate language, you know, bad words, misogynistic, homophobic, anti-Semitic, racist, just bad words. And there's the question, did he actually do anything? You know, he didn't direct them at anybody. He didn't say them to anybody. He didn't write them to anybody. He'd just written them down on a piece of paper. And you know, is that itself a bad thing? This idea comes up again and again in all these different iterations of the power of language, both to do bad and to do good, and kind of identity-making language as well.
I know. I was thinking, like, this is like one of the most Jewish books I've ever read, but then I thought about it being kind of Catholic in the sense that all these thoughts are equivalent to deeds, or they may very well be equivalent to deeds, for which penance is required. Except Jews don't get the penance. They don't get the deal. They don't get to say five Hail Marys.
It's funny, when I started sharing the book, just with, you know, the first few readers, and one of the responses I got was, this is a very Jewish book. And I was really surprised. Really, really surprised just now how I thought about it at all when I was writing it. And my friends were surprised by my surprise. You know, like, how could you not see it? It's just so gratuitous, or so explicit. But I wasn't aware of it. I was aware of writing a story about home, about family, about connection, about isolation, sharing, withholding, these themes that are not in any way exclusive to any culture. But I was writing them, of course, with like a very particular cultural context. that I was aware of. You know, it is the context is Jewish, just as it's very American, just as it's very upper middle class. But that was just the setting, not the message isn't quite the right word, but not the substance.
Well, like in one interview, how you kind of said, maybe this isn't an autobiographical, but this is me. It's like when I first am introduced to the three children, you know, Sam, Max, and Benji, I'm going, as other reviewers have talked about the Glass family and all that stuff, I'm thinking, how can these kids be so precocious? It seems unrealistic. But then I start thinking about you three kids, and it makes sense. And then, just as in Everything is Illuminated, when it's your own name, I begin to inject you and your whole family into this book. And it's almost impossible for me not to. Do you think that's unfair of me? Do you think that it's reasonable for a reader to suppose that you're a good part and parcel of the book as well? Do you think it's unreasonable?
I mean, who am I to say what's reasonable or unreasonable? I can tell you my own truth, you know, and the reader can accept that or not. At the end of the day, a book either works for a reader or it doesn't. And at the end of the day, these questions, which are kind of interesting, and I understand like the instinct to ask them, but at the end of the day, they don't have a whole lot of bearing on whether or not a book works for you. You know, books work on such a deep level, and interesting as questions of like autobiography might be, they're not as deep as that. You know what it's like, and I know what it's like to be really profoundly moved by a reading experience. And when you are moved, all of the other stuff just kind of falls away. You know, there are definitely some autobiographical aspects, like that the book takes place in Washington, D.C., like the fact that there's divorce, that I was divorced. There are three kids. It's very Jewish. But the events in the book don't correspond to events in my life. I was not writing from a position of, like, you know, catharsis or anything like that. But that having been said, this is the first book I've written that is really driven by the third person. You know, my first two books have very strong first-person narrators. Alex, that young Ukrainian in Everything is Illuminated, and Oscar in Extremely Loud. And this book is narrated by a third person. And I think that allowed for a different kind of writing and allowed or compelled me to write sort of for my own sensibility.
One of the questions I had, and this is profound to me and has been profound to me, and growing up Jewish, but growing up Jewish like by going to synagogue on the high holidays and still having pork chops, I've always wondered, you know, if Israel were under attack, if Israel was in the throes of possible annihilation, as it's posited in your book, would I, if I was asked, and you set it up clearly, would I get on a plane and go over to help in whatever way I could? And so I would ask you the same question. Do you think that you would do that? Because I've always wondered, it's like the question, you know, would you run in front of a moving train to push a little girl out of the way? I've always wondered whether I would respond as if this was my very core nature to respond viscerally if I was called.
It comes right back to that.
Here I am.
Question of the power of words. Well, here I am for sure, but also, you know, to the power of words, and you know, what is the relationship between what we say about ourselves and who we actually are? So you or I might say yes, I would do this, or no, I wouldn't do it. But that's not to say that when the crisis occurred that we would.
Which is exactly what happens in the book too.
Right, and certain things that we can't know without a crisis. And, you know, it's it's the exact same thing in the marriage, you know, until they are, both of them are really forced to locate themselves, forced to make a choice. They can sort of be there and sort of not be there. And if asked, you know, is your marriage working? Do you want to stay in this relationship? They would have answers, but they're not necessarily reflective of a truth. I think that sometimes the truth can only be known, when the hits the fan.
Well, it's funny because with Jacob and Julia, they work so hard. I mean, I'm divorced, you're divorced. I didn't work as hard as I should have to watch out for that first step the wrong way. And they really watched out. Early on, they had rituals and they had things that they did to fail-safe mechanisms so that they would stay close together and that they would always remember. And then all of a sudden, he turns the papers down on the kitchen table and doesn't read the quote of the best thing he ever wrote. And it's so funny how that happens. And it's like sliding doors or something. Like, if you could just go back to that moment, and if you just turned the page over and read this and she said, "You're my writer," then they'd still be married and everything would be fine and the book would be different or not available. But isn't it funny how that happens?
Well, it's these massive destructions are the result of tiny movements. You know, like the little withholdings that just accumulate. And accumulate to a point of, you know, being unable to find your way back. So they do try, yeah. And I mean, I think, they probably try harder with the kids than they do with each other. They're both very invested in family. I don't know how honestly invested they are in their marriage.
I'm not sure. That's a good point. I mean, it's a good point. Obviously, you made it. You're not sure. I think the reader is not sure either. It looks like. Yeah, they were really, really in love, and they're really, really trying hard. But you know, maybe it's just even the ceremony itself, and the way Julia decides to act during the ceremony. One funny thing that happened was I have a friend who read the book, and she read it on audio book, and she was listening to it in her car, but she had her kids in the car, and she didn't realize the italicized things would be coming on in a different voice like that, or that was even part of the book. So that was...
I probably owe her an apology.
It was quite a shock for her. She thought someone was in the car.
That's really funny.
But
kids have to learn somewhere.
Yeah. What's the difference between having a bar mitzvah and becoming a bar mitzvah? Explain that to people who might not understand any of that.
So having one, it refers to an event that takes place on a day sometime around your 13th birthday, if you're a boy, your 12th, if you're a girl. And, you read from the Torah and you fulfill certain rituals and you have completed the event. To be one, I think, is... means to really inhabit a kind of adulthood. And it's easier to, as with so many things, it's easier to have than to be.
Was Tamir fun to write? He's such an interesting character and he's such an emblem of Israel, but he was also so full of life and so full of humor and so present in the book. Was he a fun character to write?
Super fun. Super duper fun. And, I found the whole book fun to write. Even the parts that were really not funny, challenging. But I felt engaged with the writing of this book in a way that was actually new for me. And Tamir, Jacob, the kids were really fun. Writing Sam and Other Life was really fun. The pornographic stuff, which you were just referring to, was really fun. I mean, it's a book that had a lot of sort of trauma and drama.
Did you know what a Cincinnati bow tie was, or did you look in the Urban Dictionary? Because I had no idea.
You just don't get out enough. Maybe I get out too much. I don't. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't remember if I knew, but I was searching for just the dirtiest thing I could possibly find, and that was the best I could do.
Was a good one.
You know, it really was.
In today's political climate, you know, and watching the book progress through hardback as the election cycle unfolded, and then watching on YouTube your interview about what you did before the election and election day and election night, and then watching and listening to you say things that I don't really want to say on the radio here, what you've said about Trump, not that it was that bad, but what do you feel now, and do you think anything in your novel presages or kind of reflects what's happening in our country now? Do you think there's any correlation at all?
Well, I definitely didn't anticipate it. You know,
I know you didn't.
Right up to the night.
No,
right up until this moment, I'm in a state of denial.
Every morning, it's so funny because you know I've interviewed 400 authors in this show, and every author feels exactly the same way about Donald Trump, and it took me a while to realize why that's true. No matter who I interview. It's because authors are smart. It's because authors are intelligent. And so they obviously have to feel that way about Trump. And
You know what? I don't know if I agree. I think that...
Why then?
I think that a lot of people who supported Trump are smart as well. It's not a question of intelligence. It's a question of hope. And I think writers are probably innately hopeful. I mean, there's something sort of fundamentally or definitionally hopeful about writing and reading, like committing oneself to a belief that you can be understood, you can understand another.
Well,
and I think the people who voted for Trump are not ignorant, and I don't think they're racist. I think they're people who have lost hope for different reasons.
I don't know.
And
but it's...
I think people without hope can often... you know, a charismatic person with the right message, the right messenger, in a time of an absence of hope, is able to get a lot of people to believe in him. And you know, to some extent, Obama was the same thing, just coming from you know the polar opposite end of the spectrum. So, I think it's dangerous to underestimate. I think it's wrong.
Except he spells counsel wrong like three or four different ways in his tweets. So like, just that alone is impeachable, I think.
Well, there's a lot of different kinds of intelligence. You know, he might say, yes, but you're worth, you know, $20. Like, there are a lot of ways to judge somebody's value in the world.
Then I have another theory. The theory is this, and you said it too, because you said you still can't believe it. I think that authors, you know, they write worlds. You created a world in this book, a world that didn't exist, and a world I'll always remember, and names of characters that I'll remember Sam and Max, and I'll remember their names. And so you create this world, but you have to wake up in the morning now, and everything's fine when you wake up until you go, Donald J. Trump is president of the United States. And I think maybe authors get confused because then they find that they're in a world that seems to be as illusory as the ones they create themselves, because it's really hard to take in and actually believe. How about that one?
Well, there's definitely something to that. Although I have to say, again, you know, when Obama was elected, I had to pinch myself just for different reasons.
Yeah,
but that also had an aspect of disbelief. But in a funny way, that's like the greatest risk of getting used to things that are destructive. know, being lulled into new kinds of normalcy that if they weren't your reality, you would never accept, but because they're your reality, you're almost compelled to accept them. But the good news is that hasn't happened at all. Like, the surrealness of it or the unbelievability of it, the incredibility of it, has only kind of grown.
Yeah, that's definitely true, even as we speak. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. I don't want to go off into subjects off of the book, but thank you so much for answering the questions and also being patient with me for asking questions that I know you've been being asked for the past year and a half. So I really appreciate it.
Can't step into the same river twice.
Well, thank you again.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. That was Jonathan Safran Foer talking to us about his new book. Well, it's not really new, but it's newly issued in paperback, or will be tomorrow, Here I Am. It's a great book, story of a disintegration of a marriage, the possible destruction of Israel, history of four generations of a family, how they stay together and how sometimes they fall apart. Anyway, he's one of three really intelligent, erudite brothers who have all won all kinds of awards, and I'm going to be interviewing this third brother. I've interviewed Joshua for Moonwalking with Einstein, who also wrote Atlas Obscura, and I'll be interviewing the third brother coming up next month. And speaking of upcoming authors, I'll be interviewing Catherine Scott Clark to discuss her new book, The Exile, which is the stunning inside story of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda in flight, which is cool because it's not like anything you've ever read. All the stuff you've read about his capture, all the stuff you've read about his hiding out in Pakistan, it's all turned on its head. It's all topsy-turvy. So, fascinating book. Then, completely different, Linda Mapes will discuss her latest work, Witness Tree, which is Seasons of Change with a Century-Old Oak. She lives in the Harvard forest, and she follows this oak tree over an entire season, and she talks about how climate change affects it and how it affects us, and it's a really good ecological excursion into what's happening in our world today. And then this really cool book by Weiqi Wang called Chemistry, which is her debut, and it's really hilarious, and it's really oddball, and it's really definitely tilted in a strange kind of way. Very enjoyable book. So we have those three coming up and plenty more. Rebecca has really lined up a good bunch of authors for us coming up through the rest of spring and almost all the way into midsummer. So thanks as always for listening, and we look forward to having you back here next week on the Abbott Reader.